My name is Valerie Payne, and this is the podcast Binding Unity. I started this podcast because of a personal experience that helped me to see the need for unity in our society right now. I hope that you will come along with me on my quest to find unity as we seek understanding, connection, healing, and love. Hi, this is Valerie Payne, and you're listening to another episode of Finding Unity. And today I have Michael White with us. Michael, do you want to say hi?
Yeah. Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me on today.
I'm super excited to chat with you a little bit about what we've talked about. Before we dive into the topic, I wanted you to just kind of give a little bit of background about yourself, maybe where you grew up, your family, just those basics.
Sweet. Yeah. So as Valerie was saying there, my name is Michael White. I grew up down in Mapleton, Utah, which is it was a small area when I was growing up, but now I feel like it's gotten big. Yeah, spent most of my time there as far as in Mapleton. Served a mission in London, England. Went to school at BYU and studied communications, advertising, kind of the communication side of things. The reason why I laugh about that is because I don't do that anymore. It's funny, I graduated BYU and I did PR for a short little while and very quickly decided it really wasn't in my wheelhouse. And at the time, I actually had been teaching seminary at Springville High School for a little while. And absolutely loved that job. And then also taught down at Maple Mountain High School. At the time, the church had a policy where as a male, you could not be a single male and teach seminary. And so I'm single. And so they kind of were like, go get engaged. And so I was like, all right, well, I can't do that job anymore. So then I got into software sales.
You mean you didn't just get engaged?
I didn't just get engaged. Nope. Yeah, it's been six, 7 years at this point, which I don't think that's their policy anymore. You know, if it is, okay, that's great. But anyway, but that pushed me into software sales, which is what I do now. And so I love doing sales. I love working with people, speaking with people, traveling. And so honestly, my passion in life is really just being around friends and family. So kind of a boring life, but that's me.
Awesome. No, I think it's a very fascinating life. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the topic that we're going to be diving into, and that is OCD, specifically scrupulosity. So do you want to talk a little bit about what that is for people who maybe haven't heard that term, scrupulosity?
Yeah, definitely. So oftentimes when people think of OCD, they're thinking of like an obsessive compulsive disorder with like germs, right? You touch something and you think you immediately need to go wash your hands. I know for me, for example, I used to always think of the movie What About Bob, right? which, sorry, is just funny thinking of that. Scrupulosity is more of like a religious OCD, a perfectionism, if you will, to where you think that you'll never be good enough, essentially. And that's something that I've battled for for over 20 years of my life. I'd love to say that I'm over it, but I definitely still go through bouts of it. And it's made great, great, hilarious stories and moments of just absolute just anxiety and panic. And then they turn into funny stories later on. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being willing to talk about it, because I've met quite a few people with it, but not many people feel comfortable talking about it in a public or on a public platform. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thanks for being willing to talk about it. Yeah. You mentioned a little bit about it being this sense of not feeling good enough. And so what would you say is the difference between, because I think a lot of people can relate to not feeling good enough.
Yeah.
So what would you say is the difference between maybe generally not feeling good enough and maybe not feeling good enough in an OCD light?
Yeah, great question there. So couple of things that I'd shed light on with that is, number one, we'll tie it back into the germs analogy, right? Like when you're thinking of germs, like I'm conscientious of germs. I wash my hands. But when I'm washing my hands so much that it's disrupting my living, my daily life, to where I'm getting cracks in my hands, or to where it's distorted thoughts, it's the same thing with this. To the point to where you feel like you're having to, almost earn your place in God's presence, right? To an absolutely distorted point of view. I'll go into some examples here later on, but you know, to me, that's where there's a big difference of like, I'm not good enough versus like, I will never be good enough. I can't think of anything good about me, or everything I do will always fall short. It's a very black and white thinking. Either I get an A plus or I get an F. There's nothing in between. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've talked about this a little bit already, but is there anything you want to add about what it looks like for you specifically?
Yeah. Do you want me to just get into my story, like kind of when I was diagnosed? Okay, cool, yeah. So I think as a kid, I was a really obedient child as a kid. My parents are amazing. I have incredible parents, and I have wonderful siblings. I come from a family of five. And I am number four. It goes four boys and then a girl. So I'm the youngest of the boys. And I kind of started, even growing up with like my brothers and whatnot, I got into trouble. I did dumb things. I was like any little kid. And maybe around like the age of 10 or 11, like there were things in my life where it's like, like the little rituals. I'm trying to think of little things. For example, like things I do now, for example, I'll lock my car like 10 times. And I'm not saying that's necessarily OCD, but I kind of think it is. Like I'll hear my car beep like 10 times. I do that as a kid. Like I would go back and make sure that the lock on our house as a kid, like if I left, like that it was locked. And I'd check it maybe two or three times. just silly little things like that. By the time I was around 12, that's when I kind of started having like more intense feelings of guilt. I read the Book of Mormon at the age of 12, and I remember being terrified after praying. I remember being terrified that I was going to see some angel. And this, staying up all night, like, oh my gosh, an angel's going to appear to me. And it kind of was, I didn't understand quite what the spirit was at that point, but I received an answer of what I believed and knew at that time was kind of like a tree trunk moment, I guess you could say, in my testimony, in at least the Book of Mormon, that what I had read was something that was good, that it was from God. And immediately, because I had that testimony experience, I thought of all these things that I was doing wrong as a kid. And they were funny things. Like, for example, I remember, for example, not even necessarily cheating off of a friend, but we were in seventh grade and like me and a buddy were doing a homework assignment together. And because he and I came up with the same answer, and it was a math assignment, right? There's only one answer. But because we came up with the same answer, but we were doing it together, I thought, oh my goodness, I just cheated off of him, which of course is silly. We did it together. But because of that, in my head, I thought I gotta now pay the penalty. So I deliberately crossed out the right answer and wrote down the wrong answer, almost as like a penance. Another time I was in seventh grade band and a girl who was playing the flute stood up for like a test. We were doing like a playing test. And as she was playing the flute, I remember thinking how cute she looked. And I think they were bell bottoms is what they're called. I'm so, like I said, family of boys. But I remember thinking how cute she looked in these bell bottoms. And how, 12-year-old boy, just not like necessarily dirty thoughts, but just thoughts of like, oh, I'd love to give her a kiss or I'd love to hold her hand. And just immediately I was like, Michael, like you are going to hell for that. And my dad at the time was my bishop. And my parents kind of started noticing these little things, where I kind of started, and like I said, I've just given you two examples, but take these examples and multiply them by like 10 or 20 things in a day of intense guilt. And my parents kind of started noticing this, and at first they thought, they're like, okay, he's depressed. Let's get him on some antidepressant, which they did. And to be honest, it did help. They put me on Prozac, and it did help. But it wasn't until my dad was talking to a member of our high council who is a therapist, and he said, Don, it's my dad's name. He said, bring him in to see me, and he and I can talk, and you and your wife can come with. And so I went into the therapist And that's when he diagnosed me with OCD, with obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, I didn't know it was called scrupulosity at that point, but he just said, Mike, you have an overactive conscience. And for the next, years and years, I went through kind of battling this idea or understanding of that it's okay to screw up and that God isn't going to just damn me in my tracks because I do screw up. And so that's kind of the gist of as far as how it got started. So it started when I was 12 and years of therapy. I still go to a therapist. I mean, you know, every 3 months I'll go into a therapist and sometimes I don't even need to talk to him. Sometimes it's just literally he and I just talking about random stuff. And other times it's like, I'm like, no, I need him like to see him today. I consider it like my mental oil change, if you will.
Yeah.
And if I need to see him more, that's great. If I don't, then hey, I just saw my therapist that day and it was great. So
did you say your parents started to recognize it was a problem and you started to see the therapist when you were 12?
Yeah. My parents, it definitely, they noticed it because I've always been a very outgoing individual. And honestly, while this was going on, no one would have guessed that I was going through this, but they noticed it at home. And especially because my dad was my bishop, I started confessing everything to him. The girl in band confessed that to him. The friend who I thought I cheated off of, I confessed that to him. Literally, he would drive me to school every single day. And like I said, he was my bishop. And I would make a list of everything that I needed to confess to him between, and it was maybe a 7-minute drive from my house to the school. And during that drive, I would just confess the entire list. I literally during the day would make a list of everything I did wrong that day, which is funny because half the time, not even half the time, 99% of the time, they weren't even things I did wrong. They were things like, what if this or what if that? And, you know, I can't even think of a time actually where my dad was like, Mike, that's something that, you know, we need to talk more about. There were always things like, Mike, you're okay. It's kind of the confessing part kind of turned into like the germaphobe washing their hands.
Yeah.
It feels good for a moment, but then germs are going to come back on you. So you got to wash again. That's kind of what it became to me. That became like my compulsion where I had to keep confessing to feel clean, which is the silly part. And which is funny because like I said, they were hilarious things. I mean, absolutely. I remember one time being in the shower and I thought the warm water on my body because it felt good. I thought that that was a sin, like just such silly, silly things.
Yeah.
You know, so,
you know, you mentioned your father was your bishop.
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give to bishops? Because I have heard many bishops say, well, come to me when you feel like you need to.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone with OCD scrupulosity, that may not be beneficial because you may feel like you need to multiple times a day, like you were mentioning writing this list. Do you have any maybe like thoughts for ecclesiastical leaders in working with people who have OCD scrupulosity or may have those tendencies?
Yeah. I mean, first off, I mean, you obviously can always go to a bishop. I mean, I love my dad being my bishop and I've loved my bishops. I think that when they recognize that someone has this, it's someone where, like I said, they'll be coming in for silly things or repeatedly coming in for silly things. Not necessarily that they can't forgive themselves for something, but just things where it's like they almost feel like they have to like earn their way into heaven repeatedly. To give an example, I can think of one particular bishop when I'd probably been home for my mission, I don't know, maybe a year or so. And some things in my head that it came up, which were super silly. I remember literally on Christmas Eve, I called him up. And this was when I was going through like a bout. This isn't super common for me at this point. In fact, this was probably after my mission, it was probably the most recent thing. I called him up on Christmas Eve and I was like, Bishop, we got to meet. And he was so nice and he met with me and he kind of didn't know how to react to what I was telling him. I honestly don't even remember what it was about. But I think he kind of was like, well, that's really weird. Like, this isn't really a big deal of what you're telling me. But he kind of was, you know, he was nice and it was at his house and he's like, well, you know, Mike, everything's good. You're good. And 4 months later, I felt like I needed to go see him again for the same thing. And I went into his office. What was it for? I can't even remember what it was for. That shows you how silly it was, by the way, right? Anyway, I went into his office. And as soon as I got into his office, he looked at me and he said, Mike, if it's for the same thing that we talked about Christmas, get out of my office, take a Snickers bar, you're just fine. And for me, that was the perfect response, okay? Like for me, I was like, oh, okay, cool. Thanks, dude. Like, took a Snickers bar and I walked out. Right. I mean, that's, I took that just fine. And so, but for bishops, I mean, when you recognize that, I definitely would recommend that, you know, number one, that they, well, sorry, I'm rambling here. I hope that's okay. Number one, I would talk about, for me, the greatest thing that's helped me is learning about the topic of grace. Maybe pull that up. And then I would recommend that they, once again, have this individual talk to a therapist, mm-hmm. and help them understand that, like, no, your self-worth is much more than just like your actions. And that number one or number two, your actions really aren't probably as bad as what you think.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. You've talked a little bit about how OCD has impacted your life. Can you talk about it more on a daily basis? Like, how, when you have these bouts, mm-hmm. how does it impact your life?
Yeah, it goes in waves for me. I don't know if this is the case with everyone else, but I feel like it goes in waves, and it's tied with other stressors in my life. So if I'm stressed about something else, whether it's dating or whether it's school or whether it's work, I notice it flares up as well. So the first thing for me with identifying like distorted thoughts in like my daily life is if I notice there are distorted thoughts in like all areas of my life, if that makes sense. One of the hard things with like anxious thoughts is actually identifying that they're not that they're not real, but that they're not as threatening as what it feels in your head, regardless of scrupulosity or whatever these anxious thoughts are, right? And so the way I do that is if I notice that I'm having anxious thoughts across multiple areas of my life, and when I mean anxious, I mean like stupid thoughts. I'm trying to think of examples. Like if I'm feeling super unworthy for, you know, for whatever reason, okay? You know, for something silly, you know, like I'll get an example for, you know, the first year I came home from my mission, I remember kissing a girl and I did nothing wrong, but I was convinced I was going to hell. Anyway, sorry, I laugh because it's really funny to me. You know, but then I remember having that thought, and then I had the same thoughts of, and at this point I'd been home about a year. I remember having this similar anxious thoughts about school and how if I failed a particular test, I wouldn't get into my major, which meant that I'd become a homeless man. Like, you know, just distorted thoughts in various areas. And if I can recognize those, then it's like, okay, I know I'm probably experiencing anxious thoughts just in general. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the first one as far as on like the day-to-day life is really pointing out those anxious thoughts. And then the second thing with those anxious thoughts is just being able to let go of them. Almost prolonging that anxiety and then realizing like, no, you're going to be okay. Like, you know, you fail the test. Okay. You're going to be fine. You know, it's to me, that's the big one is if you can prolong that feeling and then realize, no, your life is going to move on, then that's what's really helped me get through that. Almost like a mini exposure therapy, if you will.
Great. Awesome. Thanks. So you've talked a little bit about how it's impacted your life. I guess I'm curious first, has it ever caused you to like lose a job or impact you in that way? You know what I mean?
Yeah, great question there. So no, it hasn't had me lose a job, at least not that I know of. but one of the things that's interesting with OCD in general, in my opinion, is there's pros and cons to it. When it comes to work or schoolwork, like I can get engrossed in work very quickly because I can become very passionate about it. Everyone has a little bit of OCD in them because we're all passionate about something. It's when we let it loose, like really just get out of control. Right. And so for me, when it comes to schoolwork or work, I kind of let it loose, not in a way of any unhealthy reasons, but like if I want to focus and I really want to get work done or if I really want to study, to me, it's like I can really just get in the books and just put my nose to the grindstone and get there until I feel like I've, you know, essentially hit what I needed to hit. Now, like I said, you have to be careful on that because sometimes that can get to just absolutely unhealthy amounts, but I don't think I've ever had that happen.
So it sounds like it hasn't necessarily impacted you negatively in a secular sense. But how would you say it's impacted your relationships, maybe dating, also familial relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great question there. I mean, familial, you know, my siblings didn't know a thing about this as I was growing up. None of my friends did either. In fact, the first time I really talked about it, like publicly was when I was 18 on a mission farewell. And then even now, not even anything crazy. You know, sometimes people will make a joke here or there, and it may be a little offensive, but I was just kind of shrug it off. Dating's a whole other beast, because I hate dating. So I hope there's people out there that can, you know, relate to that. Dating, it's so as I talked about earlier, like I came home from my mission, and so all through middle school, junior high, high school, I could keep it in check, the OCD, and like I said, I go through bouts of it, but I never had to face it with dating, because I never dated anyone in high school, and I knew I didn't want to, because, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but when I was in high school, I was like, I don't want a girlfriend before my mission. The only girl I ever kissed in high school was in a school play. And so it was very black and white for me. I just kind of avoided that, so I didn't have to confront any guilt, if you will, at that time. I then came home from my mission, and all of a sudden everyone's trying to get married, everyone's dating. You go to BYU, dating apps came out the year I came home from my mission. I mean, that was a doozy. I remember one particular girl who, she is just an incredible human being. I remember she's literally the first girl I kissed when I was home from my mission, and I felt so guilty over it. I felt so guilty. The reason I felt guilty is because I was interested in her, but then after kissing her, I wasn't that interested in her. Or I had kind of a panic attack over it because I was scared of committing to her, and yet I just kissed her. And it's funny looking back on this, like just thinking of this. I felt so guilty. I remember going home, and I just bawled my eyes out. And my dad, I still lived in my parents' house because I was saving up money for rent. My dad was there, and he was like, "What's wrong?" And I kind of told him, and he kind of asked me a couple questions. He's like, "Well, did you do anything wrong? Did you do this?" And I was like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. And he was like, "Well, what's wrong with you? Go kiss her again." And I was like, "Oh, no." So I went to my therapist, and it was the first time I went to my therapist in, it'd probably been like 4 or 5 years. My mission, that's the funny thing, is with my mission, you know, I was kind of there, but a lot of people get this on their mission. This did not faze me at all on my mission. And dating, like I said, threw a wrench into it. So I went to this therapist, and this therapist, he was like, "Mike, this is something that's normal. Like you got to get over this." And I was like, and I knew it. Of course I knew it. In my head, it all made sense. But in my heart, it's like, I just felt terrible. And so the therapy he told me is, I think the month was like, when was it? It was probably like June or July. It was probably, you know, around this time of year. And he was like, "Okay, between now and the end of the year, I want you to go and kiss 5 girls you are genuinely interested in." And I was like, no, I can't do that. And he's like, "No, you have to." And he's like, "Make sure you're interested in them." I was like, "Okay." And it's the best therapy I've ever had for multiple reasons. But, you know, the big one being that I was facing something that's like, like I said, it's prolonging that fear, and it's getting over that fear to where it's like, "Mike, this is silly. You're just fine."
So yeah, how would you say, I'm interested, like kissing the 5 different girls, what about that helped you? Honestly, like, yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, number one, it was great. Best therapy on earth. Once again, it came down to that exposure therapy. So to give you an idea, at the same time, I had... It literally at the same time, because like I said, it goes into different areas of my life. I was getting scuba certified, and I was driving up Provo Canyon, and I had a panic attack while driving by Deer Creek. I've never been in a car wreck. I've never had any kind of speeding ticket. This shocked me that I had a panic attack. It was the first panic attack I ever had in my life where, like, I felt like I was having a heart attack. I was getting tunnel vision, like, and I was driving. I was terrified that I was going to crash the car into Deer Creek Reservoir. Anyway, so that really freaked me out. That really, really freaked me out. And this was, like I said, at the same time. So I was talking with the therapist about this. And the same thing, the therapy he gave me is, he said, "Mike, you have to drive that road every day for a month." And I did. And I probably the first 15 to 20 days of driving it, I had panic attacks. I thought for sure I was going to die. And by about day 20, 21, and my mom for the first maybe 10 or 12 days would drive it with me, and I just bawl my eyes out. Yeah, she's in the shotgun and I'm driving Deer Creek. And but by about day 20, it's like you finally realize like this is a distorted thought.
So with the driving and the panic attack, it sounds like the fear behind that was like, I'm going to die. Or I'm going to get in a car accident. Uh-huh. What was the fear behind kissing?
Yeah. Right? I don't know. No, it was that I had done something inappropriate. You know, it was the first time I'd ever kissed a girl, you know, and not just kissed. I mean, I made out with that girl. But it was the first time that was ever the case. The first time that, you know, really, you know, I had to deal with was that okay or not? Did I just do something that was dirty or not? And so by kissing five other girls, I think for him, he was just trying to get over the fact that it was like, Mike, this isn't dirty. Like this you is
also,
just fine.
And you also mentioned like commitment when you first made out with her, like, yeah. Oh, I don't know what I want. Mm-hmm. Do you think there was some fear there?
Yeah, I think it came down to, so that's the funny thing with, well, especially when I first came home from my mission, I kind of had in my head that I was like, I'll get married at the age of 24, which is hilarious because that's like been almost a decade for me at this point. But the girls I would date then, commitment definitely scared me because I didn't feel like I was ready for marriage at that time. And for whatever reason at that time, I thought if I went on even second or third dates, to me, I was like, oh my gosh, does this mean more than what it is? Like, does it mean more commitment? And so I was definitely worried about that. I don't know if that was from a scrupulous standpoint or an obsessive standpoint. It probably was, honestly, thinking about it. But it definitely, commitment did freak me out. Now, post when I have wanted to get married, you know, even, are you okay if I get into that with my dating life?
Yeah.
Like, the ways it's affected me is, I think like you get like the grass is greener syndrome, and that's something that I've had to battle, you know, even up until now. And I don't think I'm unique in this, but to where it's like, you know, you're dating someone, and when you're saying the words, what if, you can almost guarantee that that's coming from an anxious thought. What if this, what if there's someone out there who's better for me? What if I marry this person and this happens? Or what if I marry this person and that happens, right? You fill in the blank and you're negatively predicting the future. And that's where I have seen this, at least in my dating life, is I want to find someone who has or who is perfect. Maybe not a perfect past, but someone who is perfect for me. And they have all of these traits. And if they're missing this trait, then all of a sudden I start overthinking it. And I mean, you can see where that can get controlling or where that can get poisonous, and not necessarily that that's happened to me. It probably has in a sense. And if it has, then I, like I said, I'm not perfect. It's something I'm working on, but that's something that I've noticed even now that I'm just, you know, that I just constantly have to work on. So,
yeah. And kind of, you mentioned you don't feel like you're alone in this, aspect of dating anyway. And the what if syndrome. Mm-hmm. With scrupulosity specifically, I feel like there's probably a lot of people who struggle with it but don't realize it. Mm-hmm. And so do you have any maybe thoughts or words or advice for people who may be in this situation, maybe they don't even realize or that they have OCD in the scrupulous form?
Yeah. I mean, if you're feeling like you're never good enough or that you have to constantly be earning your way in God's eyes, then you probably in some way, shape, or form have a little bit of this.
So what about the scripture, faith without works is dead?
Yeah, great question there. So for me, it comes down to, once again, that grace point. So works in my eyes, works are to the heart is like a plow is to stony ground. Like the reason that I go to church or that I don't know. I mean, you fill in any work that I'm charitable, that I go and do service or whatever, is to like plow up the stony areas of my heart. That does not get me to God, though. It teaches me how to become like God. As I said earlier, studying the topic of grace, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard the talk by Brad Wilcox, His Grace is Sufficient. That talk is an incredible talk. In fact, there was a study, I don't know if it's done at BYU or where it was done, Oh man, I wish I had that on me. I apologize. But it was a study where on individuals who have OCD and particular scrupulosity, that when they studied the topic of grace, that their guilt as well as like the intensity of that anxiety, that was one of the best ways to decrease that in their life. And before I even knew about that study, like that was 100% the case for me, because I knew that once again, the whole reason of me doing works isn't, and the quote by Brad Wilcox, isn't to earn heaven, but is to learn heaven. Mm-hmm. That the whole point was to make my heart pure, not to make my actions pure. You know, as with an OCD thought, I would think if I died in my sins, then I wasn't going to be good enough. Whereas with Jesus Christ, the beauty of it is if I die in my sins, but as long as I'm being the best Michael that I can be, the best me, it's like, then Jesus will take care of the rest. And that's kind of where that goes along the lines with that.
I love that. I feel like you've given some really good advice as far as talking about grace and how the study of grace has been helpful. And it sounds like there's a study on that as well that shows that that's helpful.
Yeah, I got to go find that. I'm so sorry. I don't know that off the top of my head.
No, so you mentioned grace. And then you've also mentioned exposure therapy and distorted mm-hmm. thinking, which I would say cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, CBCT.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about those and how those have helped you, or anything else, any other tools that have helped you that you feel that may benefit people listening?
Talking to people. So two things with that. Number one, when you say a distorted thought out loud, in your head, it seems super real.
Will you give an example of a distorted thought for people who don't really know what that means or looks like?
Yep. For example, I'm driving along Deer Creek and I'm going to somehow swerve off and crash into the water. Okay, right. I mean, because that's what was going through there. Okay. I'll give you another one. A couple weeks back, I was visiting my parents on their mission. We went deep sea fishing and we went out miles. I hate open water, by the way, which I scuba dive, which is so ironic. But I hate open water. We went out miles. I was terrified somehow our boat would break and we would just be stuck out there or get sucked out in some current, right? Just thoughts that it's just, they're not rational thinking, okay? I'll use the Deer Creek analogy with that. What was your question with that? I rambled for a minute.
Just what other, I wanted you to give an example of distorted thinking, but prefaced that was just maybe what tools have helped you.
Thank you. That's it. So once again, saying it out loud. Okay. For me, saying things out loud is a huge, huge, the fact that you can hear what you're saying, it's a big difference of it in your head versus when you verbally say it and you hear what you're saying, huge difference. You hear how stupid it sounds. Number two, writing it down. I love journaling. Journaling makes me realize so many things where it's like, yeah, that's ridiculous. But then it also lets me kind of vent my thoughts, which is nice. And then number three is talking to people. That's why I love therapy. I'll talk to my parents. I'll talk to loved ones. That kind of helps with the whole talking about it out loud, but then it also gives you a fresh perspective from someone who's outside of what you're experiencing, and you need to be okay with them kind of not laughing at you. And you can tell them, just say, hey, these are very real in my head, but with them kind of saying like, yeah, Mike, I think that's probably kind of silly or something like that. And you got to be humble enough to admit that. It's okay. It's totally fine. But those are the three that I think have been great tools that I use all the time.
Great. Thanks for sharing those. You know, President Nelson, who's the prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, for those who may not know who are listening, gave a talk about labels and how we shouldn't let labels define us. How have you not let the label of OCD define you?
Yeah, great question. For me, number one, and in that particular talk, you know, number one, like, I am a son of God. And, you know, we talked about grace and the grace of Jesus Christ and how that's enough for anything and everything, right? Like, as I remember that, I mean, that's a big deal to me in realizing, like, God didn't create throwaway children, right? He didn't send us here to see how many people he could fail. There's no point in that. But the whole point is to become like him, right? you know, as we are spirit children of our Heavenly Father, I mean, it is to become like Him. So, I mean, that's the first label. The next one being that, yeah, I have OCD. I don't know that I would particularly wish that I didn't have this, but I also, and the reason I say that sounds really weird, but the reason I say that is because, like, we get into the Bible and there's the scripture where Paul talks about how all things work together for our good for those who serve God. I misquoted that, but you guys know the gist of it. You know, it's kind of like tying that in with the scripture in the Book of Mormon with the brother of Jared. It's like we all have just like a bunch of rocks in life. I have OCD. I'm probably going to have a lot of other rocks in life. Some people get divorced. Some people experience death of a child. Other people experience financial difficulties, job loss, whatever, right? We're all going to go through different things. And those moments, or even if it's a lifetime moment, it's not your label. It may define you and shape you in a way, but it's not your label. But the beauty of it is as you give it to God, as you give Him that rock and He touches it, He's going to make it glow. And even though OCD sucks, it shaped me into so many positive aspects of my life today. Like I said, one area is like, I know I can outwork so many people because of that. Number two is I did not fall into so many traps as a teenager that a lot of my friends did because I was so terrified of them, right? I was so terrified of so many of those things because of the OCD. Satan just tried to get me to feel guilty over dumb things I didn't do, right? But I don't have to deal with that now as an adult because I've never gone through it. I mean, there's so many positive things that is like I've taken this thing that just sucks and given it to Jesus, that He's touched the stone that I've given Him and He's made it glow. And so it doesn't define me, but it shaped me into a beautiful person of who I am today and into being the ultimate label of being a son of God.
I love that. Yeah, I feel like what you shared about labels and just your relationship with deity and being able to balance that with the scrupulosity, I think is really powerful. Do you feel like there's anything maybe culturally in the church or in places of faith, other churches that maybe aren't helpful for people with scrupulosity? And would you speak to that?
Yeah, yeah. I once had a bishop tell me, and I have no idea if this is true or not, so take it for what it's worth. But I once had a bishop tell me that, you know, Jews, Catholics, and Mormons are the ones who struggle with scrupulosity. And he kind of giggled after that, so I don't know if that's like anything scientific or not. But I think culturally, when it comes to like the gospel, not even the gospel, let me rephrase that. Culturally, when it comes to the church, that sometimes I think especially maybe 40 years ago, maybe kind of the era that my parents grew up in, that there was kind of a heavy emphasis on, you know, you do these works and then you kind of get your place. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that's not good, because that is good. Remember, we're learning heaven, right? We do certain things, and that's what teaches us. We're learning the laws of God, essentially. We're learning the laws of heaven. And that's why I do them. That's why I want to be charitable. You know, it's that is the whole point. The culture that I think sometimes seeps in is sometimes people weaponize that learning the laws of heaven. Maybe people don't, but maybe in your head or in our individual heads, we weaponize it of like, if I don't do this, then this is what will happen. If I don't, fill in the blank, whatever the calling is, whatever the assignment is, whatever the ordinance is by, you know, whatever age or et cetera. You know, sometimes we think that there's these check boxes that we have to do by a particular time. And if we don't do that, then either we're behind or we're somehow not measuring up in God's eyes. When yet the reality is like Jesus's atonement is infinite. It's eternal. There's no timeline to it. The whole point of it is to take your heart, make it soft, so that way, whatever habits you die in, because all of us have favorite habits we're going to die in, no matter what, whatever it is that we die in, that when we're dead and we have that soft heart, we're keeping our covenants, which includes repenting, like it's going to be on the right course to making it back to our Heavenly Father. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the culture. That is the gospel. And so, you know, whether that culture that I was talking about in the church is something that's internally, like in our own heads, or whether it's something that's outside of that, I feel like there's been a good shift, at least, that's taking place there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, what I'm hearing you say is maybe 40 years ago, there was a little bit more black and white thinking.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you had McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith, who are amazing individuals. I read their talks all day, but they were very blunt people, right? It was very, you know, this or that. And I absolutely love them to death. I'll back them up on, I mean, they're way closer to God than I'll ever be. So, but I think, you know, sometimes, you know, one of the repercussions of that is it could be misconstrued of that black and white thinking. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being on. I just wanted to ask you, with the podcast being called Finding Unity, I define unity as finding unity through seeking understanding, healing, connection, and love. And so you've talked about ways you found healing through therapy, through exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, learning about grace. Is there anything else that you feel that you want to share on unity and maybe how you found unity, and then also what unity means to you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, like I said, I mean, it's earlier on, talking with people was a huge thing to me. You'd be shocked at how many people are willing to talk with you about that when it's true friends. And when there's someone who you truly, you know, it's almost like telling them your most embarrassing thoughts, honestly, because some of the thoughts are so ridiculous, but they're willing to listen and be your friend during those thoughts. I mean, there's something beautiful about that. And vice versa. I mean, when I have people talk with me about those thoughts, and they may seem super silly to me, but to that individual, it's super real, and I know it's real to them. I mean, there's something beautiful about that in that moment, that you can be someone who maybe doesn't understand exactly what they're going through, but you can at least be there to give them hope, to know, like, yeah, like you're going to be okay. And anyway, with as far as what unity means to me, I mean, that's really what it ties into with me. I mean, for me, unity is being able to be with others who, no matter who you are, what you've done, where you're at in life, like, they will be there for you. To me, that's how the Savior Jesus Christ is, that no matter where you are at, what you've done, like, he will be there for you. Now, it doesn't mean, my pet peeve in today's society is like the you do you kind of thing. Like, well, you do you, like, you are perfect just the way you are, which, you know, it's kind of like a half truth. It's like, yeah, you're perfect in regards of, like, you are a son or daughter of God. Like, your worth is infinite, but our whole purpose in being here is to become like God, is to learn those laws of God. And so as we strive to do that together, and we have patience with one another, and if someone, you know, maybe needs a little bit more time, you know, this life is nothing for God. 80 years is nothing for him. I guarantee he can wait a little longer to make that happen. Let's just be there for each other, and he'll sort out the rest.
I love it. It sounds like unity is really about connection and being able to connect with others. So thank you so much for being on. I hope it's been helpful for people. I know it's been really good for me to hear, and I've been really wanting to talk to you about this. So thanks for being willing to be on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I hope this made sense. I know I rambled a bit, so thank you.
That's great. Thanks. Remember that it's okay to disagree. Unity comes when we can agree to disagree while still maintaining a love for one another. For more on unity, follow us on Instagram at finding.unity or on Twitter at finding_unity.